a cry from the nation of Israel to God, looking for salvation, looking for deliverance. And kids, before you head back to Discovery, you can ask at the end of the service about the general who we learned about today in here, who didn't have a sword and didn't have a weapon. All right, we'll dismiss our children to Discovery Club. I think I know everybody here, so no need to introduce myself, but it has been a while since we were in the study of 1 Samuel, and we return to that today. I tell you that I grew up in a small town. If you know much about me, you know that. When I say small, I'm talking about 500 in that range, but it was a wonderful place in the 1950s. To grow up as a boy. We had the change of seasons, and we had, in that part of West Virginia, real winters. We had lots of snow. And in the wintertime and in the snow, which had been on the ground sometimes from Thanksgiving all the way to the end of February, sled riding was a wonderful wintertime activity, and I enjoyed it immensely. The kids in our neighborhood or in our town did as well. We had a street. The street was called Long Alley. It was mostly paved, sort of one lane. Wasn't too far from my house, and it ran on a long incline downhill. After a good snow, where things are packed down, maybe even if you had a touch of melting, and that refreezing, that was a fantastic place to sled ride. You could get on a sled, a couple of guys, and just go flying down that long hill. And it just went and went and went. That was part of what made it so much fun. The problem was, when you got to the end, the only way to enjoy it again was to endure the long walk back with your sled in tow. There were no shortcuts. If you wanted the ride, you had to take the sled and drag it all the way to the top of the hill and go again. As we open our text in 1 Samuel today, Israel had a great need for the blessing of God. The song depicts so well our need. They had a need at that time as well. But before that could happen in the life of the nation, there is, to make an analogy here, a hill to climb for Israel. The nation must first address where it is before the Lord. And it had to address the idolatry, the sinfulness, the unfaithfulness that was present in Israel at the time and had become part and parcel of the lives of these people. I'm going to open our text today in chapter 7. Just to remind you, we're still in the time period of the judges. And we know from our study of the book of Judges, this was a time in the nation which God raised up a succession of men, interspersed with a woman we know as Deborah, to lead Israel and to deliver the nation. Deliverance was always from the hand of an enemy, and always an enemy that God had brought against Israel to discipline Israel, to bring judgment on Israel for Israel's sin. And you remember the cycle that we saw in Judges. If we can step even a bit farther back to try to see the forest and not just be caught up in the detail of the trees that are close. We want to know where 1 Samuel fits in. Where does this time, specifically even in chapter 7, fit? We know that back as far as Genesis 2, the plan of God was in place and beginning to be revealed for redemption and restoration of man to again take on the image of God and fulfill the purpose of God on the earth. We know by Genesis 12 there's a blessing promised to a man named Abram, and out of him would come many nations and a seed which would end up being the blessing of the nations ultimately. We know the line through which that blessing was to come from Genesis 49 was through Judah, because the scepter, the idea of a king ruling, would never leave Judah. And so as this began to work itself out, we know the nation after the wilderness time moved into Canaan, had a great leader in Joshua, occupied much of the land as God gave them deliverance and gave them possession of the land. Joshua dies, and then Israel begins to struggle. And they don't go on and possess the land in faith. And so as they wander off into following the ways of the Canaanites, we get into this time of Judges where God brings his discipline, his judgment upon Israel, and then raises up out of his mercy when they cry out, men along with Deborah, to lead the nation and deliver the nation from the hand of the enemy. Samuel is the last judge who God placed over Israel. We know of his mother, his unique birth and upbringing. He grew up there at the tabernacle in Shiloh with Eli. We know the very first prophecy that Samuel had was about the end for Eli, the death of Eli and his family. Remember, that came as Israel did battle with the Philistines, and they camped, and remember this place, a place called Ebenezer. And Aphek was the place where the Philistines were. And you remember that sort of tale where they went back to Shiloh and they got the ark and they brought it out to the field of battle thinking, oh, if the ark's with us, we've got victory. It's done. It's hands down. We'll win. And they suffered an enormous defeat at the hands of the Philistines. And the ark was removed. The Philistines took possession of it. Unthinkable. Chapters 5 and 6 deal with the time the Philistines had the ark. And it turned out that while they had possession of the ark, the God of Israel still was in control. And he brought such calamity on the Philistines that they sent the ark back. You remember, it came back, and even when it came back, Israel, many men in Israel, stepped outside the holy parameters God had set forth. And many died because they looked in the ark, and they were not allowed to do that. So at that point in time, the ark goes to Kiriath-Jearim, and to the home of a man named Abinadab. And that's, in fact, where we pick up today with the ark there. Our text, this narrative of Samuel, has not mentioned Samuel himself since the first verse of chapter 4. So we've come through 4, 5, and 6. And now we start chapter 7, or really the second verse of chapter 7. And we're going to see what God is doing is now moving to a time where a king is finally going to reign over Israel as part of the unfolding of his plan. And what looks like sort of the mundane of life in Israel has woven into it the hand of God as he moves through, as Kim said when she was here. He's working even though we don't see it or recognize it. Same was true here in the nation of Israel as we come to chapter 7, because God is going to use Samuel in a unique way to lead this nation to the point where Israel will ultimately have a king. So we pick up at Kiriath Jearim. As you look with me at the first couple of verses of this text, we begin in verse 2. The hearts of Israel were not turned to the Lord, but let's see what they do toward the Lord. Verse 2. From the day that the ark remained at Kiriath Jearim, the time was long, for it was 20 years. And all the house of Israel lamented after the Lord. Then Samuel spoke to all the house of Israel, saying, if you return to the Lord with all your heart, remove the foreign gods and the Ashtaroth from among you, and direct your hearts to the Lord and serve him alone, he will deliver you from the hand of the Philistines. As the writer of this narrative begins this section with the plight of Israel, all Israel, it says, was lamenting after the Lord. Note how inclusive this is. The cry to God going out from his people here is pervasive. It's the nation completely crying out to him. But what does he mean when he says they were lamenting after the Lord? If you look at the Hebrew word for lament, it means kind of what you would think it would mean. It means to wail, to mourn, have a great need, and you're crying out for relief from that need. The NIV says they mourned and sought after the Lord. I think it's a pretty descriptive translation. We can conclude from that Israel was grieved and they were seeking the Lord. But stop. Why were they grieving? What was it that was causing them to grieve at this time? We know the ark was no longer at Shiloh. In fact, the inference is there is no Shiloh now. There is no center of worship at Shiloh. So were they grieving over the loss of a place to worship, to come together as a nation and worship the Lord? Well, I can't say that that was not part of it, but that's not what's suggested to us from the text. The very end of the third verse says, Samuel says, if you do these things, he, God, will deliver you from the grasp, from the hand of the Philistines. I think the problem was that in this 20 years that has elapsed while the ark has been at the house of Abinadab, the Philistines have dominated Israel. They're living under somebody else's thumb. That's not pleasant to them. It's so uncomfortable that the whole nation has been crying out. Where had Samuel been in these 20 years? There's nothing told to us about that. Our narrative simply doesn't give it to us. But what it does tell us is, I think, when the people were ready to listen, Samuel spoke. They were crying out to the Lord, and Samuel stepped up as prophet and judge and appeared before them and spoke the truth. He told them what needed to be done if they wanted God's hand to deliver them from the oppression of the Philistines. It's simple there in verse 3. They were to turn back to the Lord in total devotion. Not partial, total. Their whole heart needed to be focused upon him. And that would only happen if they completely eliminated the foreign gods from among their midst. Deliverance by the Lord was possible, but it was conditional. If you do these things, God will act on your behalf. Can you identify with the nation here. Like Israel, we often implore God to act when we have a crisis in life. Crises are often the catalyst for us to cry out to Him, and that's not all bad. Sometimes that's exactly what we need. We also need to learn from that it should not be just in the crisis that we call out. Verses 2 and 3 show us that Israel had been crying, lamenting to, wailing before the Lord, pursuing the Lord, but He did nothing. He did nothing in response. Why? Well, simply put, even as they continued to cry out to God, they were worshiping other gods. They were maintaining one foot in the Canaanite religion and the other seeking their own God. No relief from above. None. God is not interested in people who compartmentalize their lives, who say, yeah, I'm all for you, God, and especially when I have the need, you've got to come in. But otherwise, I'll live as I please. I'll do the things that I want to do here. Samuel says, it won't happen that way. You've got to get rid of the sin that's in your life. Then Yahweh will deliver you. Jesus dealt with the same principle. He said it once in Matthew 6, said it again in Luke 6, almost the same way. No man can serve two masters. You can't do it. For he will either hate the one and love the other, or he will be devoted to one and despise the other. And speaking to the Pharisees, he said, you cannot serve God and wealth. Pharisees desired financial benefits and blessings. In all our culture, we can certainly identify with them and the generations before them who tried to worship God along with the gods of their world. Samuel comes along and says, God wants the entire heart, the whole heart, not just a part. And Jesus said the same thing. It won't work to try to serve more than one master. Make a choice was the message of both Samuel and Jesus. Samuel called them simply to remember the first commandment. You shall have no other gods before me. Those were words they had. They had just abandoned them. They had pursued their own desires. And having done that, and here's the danger of that, they could not even find their own way back. They couldn't find their way back without Samuel there to lead them. But he did. And you know what? The good news is, after Samuel points out their sin, they followed the direction of their leader. Look with me at 4, 5, and 6. So the sons of Israel removed the Baals and the Ashtaroth and served the Lord alone. Then Samuel said, gather all Israel to Mizpah, and I will pray to the Lord for you. They gathered to Mizpah and drew water and poured it out before the Lord and fasted on that day and said there, we have sinned against the Lord. And Samuel judged the sons of Israel at Mizpah. We're given a little bit more by way of specifics that they were worshiping the images of Baal and Ashtaroth. These were the gods of the Canaanites. Let me read you a short thing the Bible Knowledge Commentary says about the gods to which are referred in these verses. The plural, Baals and Ashtoreths, describe the many local shrines of those Canaanite nature deities. Baal identified as the son of El, chief of the Canaanite pantheon, or as the son of Dagon, the Mesopotamian deity. was particularly recognized as the God of thunder, remember this, and rain, whose task was to make the earth fertile annually. Ashtoreth, or Astarte, was the goddess of both love and war, as were her Babylonian and Greek counterparts Ishtar and Aphrodite, respectively. She apparently functioned with Baal as a fertility deity, and by their sexual union in some magical way, the earth and all its life supposedly experienced annual rejuvenation and fruitfulness. These are the gods that Israel had pursued. As you might imagine, these gods had powerful appeal. Sexual rites as part of worship drew people. There are unmistakable parallels in our culture today as we amplify the pursuit of fulfillment in life through sex. Samuel called on the nation to put all of this away and turn to the Lord completely. Then he said, "Gather, let's all meet at Mizpah, and I'll intercede on your behalf with the Lord." And they came. Now, if you stop and think about that, I mean, it does say all Israel. That would have been a large gathering now at Mizpah. Some commentators will say, well, it was probably just all the elders of Israel. Well, I'm not hanging up on that either way. I think it was a large gathering of the nation at Mizpah. A movement from Dan in the north to Beersheba in the south. They moved together at Mizpah, which is just above Jerusalem, 5 to 7 miles there. We know Samuel had been a prophet to all of Israel. Remember, from Dan to Beersheba, they listened to him. And I think the Spirit is making a point through the author of this narrative that Samuel's ministry as a judge involves the entire nation. If you think back in the book of Judges, from Ehud to Gideon to Deborah and Barak to Samson, most of the judges dealt with a part of Israel. You know, they gathered together a group in Israel, and God gave them victory over the enemy that was there. Samuel's ministry is the entire nation, top to bottom. And I think this is significant because it's through Samuel that God is going to bring the king to Israel. That's so significant when we get to David in the blessing God intends for mankind that's going to come through the line of David. So we see in all of this the hand of God working to cause the entire nation now to gather here at Mizpah, not just part of the nation. It was a big deal, a big gathering. Now, it tells us that when they got together, there were three things that they did. They drew water and poured it out on the ground. What did that represent? Well, as you can suspect, there are different views about what it represents. Some say it's it's illustrative of the confession of sin and the forgiveness that accompanies that. That when we confess, it's like pouring the water out on the dry earth, and it just is absorbed into the ground and is no more. The sin is gone. Others say it's an act of dedication, because water is what to us? It's life-giving. We have to have it to live. And maybe they're saying here that our commitment now to Yahweh means more to us even than the water we need to drink. Either way, powerful, powerful statement there. The other thing they did was to fast. They fasted there just as an act of devotion and dedication as they came together as a nation. And then the biggest thing they did of those three was they absolutely confessed their sin. They laid it out and said, "We have sinned against you." They owned their sin at that time. This is a unique moment in the life of this nation. The entire nation coming together, confessing their sin before the Lord, and turning to Him. Huge, huge moment in the life of Israel. I thought, how many times do we come to the Lord and cry out, "We need His help. We need something from Him. We need His grace, His love, His provision in our lives." But we don't confess our sin. Terribly important to make sure that the sin is confessed. This paragraph ends with the statement that Samuel judged the sons of Israel at Mizpah. And I've looked at that and thought, why is that there? What is that really saying, that Samuel judged the sons of Israel at Mizpah? We know why they were there. We know what they did there. Why is the writer emphasizing to us that he judged them there at Mizpah? And I don't want to over-spiritualize the text, but I think the deliverance brought by Samuel, by God through Samuel, is different than with other judges. Samuel's not raised up as a warrior here. He's never going to fight a battle with the Philistines. I think the deliverance Samuel brought to them was deliverance from their sin, from their idolatry, so that their relationship with the Lord could reconnect. I think when he judged Israel there at Mizpah, it was at a time where he helped them get in a place where they could again receive the blessing of God. And I'll say again, it was a high moment in the life of the nation. But there were still challenges. Look back with me at the text at verse 7. "Now when the Philistines heard that the sons of Israel had gathered to Mizpah, the lords of the Philistines went up against Israel." Okay, so they are large and in charge in Israel at this time. So what do they pick up? There's a huge gathering that takes place at Mizpah. What's that mean? They're going to rebel. They're going to rebel against us. So let's get there and launch the attack. Pretty well thought out, I would say. They moved. They did not wait around to see what would happen. "And when the sons of Israel heard it, they were afraid of the Philistines." Not a surprising response there either, is it? They've been dominating you for 20 years. Been under their thumb. And now here they come. And Israel gets word that they're coming. Fear strikes their hearts. Verse 8, "Then the sons of Israel said to Samuel, 'Do not cease to cry to the Lord our God for us, that he may save us from the hand of the Philistines.'" Good perspective here. They turn to the prophet, the judge, and say, "Samuel, please keep on seeking the Lord for us. Intercede for us that God might deliver us." They've got the order of things right. Their faith here is in Yahweh. Look what Samuel does in verse 9. "Samuel took a suckling lamb, a very young lamb, and offered it for a whole burnt offering to the Lord. And Samuel cried out to the Lord for Israel, and the Lord answered him." The whole burnt offering symbolizes the complete dedication of the offeror. The offeror here is the nation of Israel. Samuel offering this lamb up on their behalf to the Lord, saying, We're completely devoted to you. This is evidence of that in this sacrifice. Samuel performs a priestly function here in Israel, in addition to being a prophet and a judge. And we're told the Lord answered, Yahweh answered, even as Samuel was offering the sacrifice, God's answer came. Look at verse 10 of chapter 7. Now Samuel was offering up the burnt offering, and the Philistines drew near to battle against Israel. But the Lord thundered with a great thunder on that day against the Philistines and confused them so that they were routed before Israel. They didn't do a thing. They're gathered. Samuel offered up the sacrifice, prayed to the Lord, and God moved miraculously. The God of thunder. When you hear thunder, don't be afraid of it. Realize that it speaks of the greatness of our God in a small way. This was major thunder. Do you remember that one of the characteristics the Canaanites ascribed to Baal was that he controlled the thunder? They got thunder. When they saw and heard the thunder, I believe the Philistines realized it was supernatural. This is something the gods deal with. And they were right. The God of Israel did that. And it routed them. It was so bad that they scattered. Listen to the last words of the prayer of Hannah in 1 Samuel 2:10. Those who contend with the Lord, she said, will be shattered. Against them he will thunder in the heavens. Little did she know that in the life of her son, God would answer a prayer by thundering in the heavens and deliver his people. Pretty neat. Pretty neat. Verse 11, the men of Israel went out of Mizpah and pursued the Philistines and struck them down as far as Bethkar. God's action was so effective, they only had to do mop-up duty, if you will, as a force. They pursued the Philistines west of Mizpah to a place we cannot really positively identify today. But listen then to what happened next. Verse 12, Samuel took a stone and set it between Mizpah and Shin and named it Ebenezer, saying, thus far the Lord has helped us. Samuel seizes the moment and sets up a stone monument between Mizpah, where they gathered, and a place called Shin, which probably marked how far they had driven the Philistines away. But the purpose of it is found in the meaning of the name. It's Ebenezer. Do you remember the last reference to Ebenezer in 1 Samuel? Ebenezer was that spot where they gathered to battle the Philistines. Ebenezer was the place they were gathered when they got the ark and brought it out to the field of battle. And the Philistines were at Aphek, right next to it. And there was a great battle there, and Israel lost. Had huge losses, including the loss of the ark. That was at a place called Ebenezer. This is a monument Samuel sets up and calls it Ebenezer. Great loss one place, a monument to great victory at another. The word Ebenezer means the stone of help. In the First Testament, Yahweh is sometimes called the stone of help. Genesis 49:24 is such a place. Samuel did this to remind Israel of what their God had done for them and that his strength could and would and did carry them through the battle and defeat the enemy. We need our Ebenezers, don't we? We need our reminders because as humans, we're so prone to forget what God has done. Verse 13, so the Philistines were subdued, and they did not come anymore within the border of Israel. And the hand of the Lord was against the Philistine all the days of Samuel. And the cities which the Philistines had taken from Israel were restored to Israel, from Ekron even to Gath. That's more west of those five cities of the Philistines. These two easternmost came back to Israel. And Israel delivered their territory from the hand of the Philistines. So there was peace between Israel and the Amorites, others living in the land. It's a big moment. God gave them victory and drove them away. And they were also able to have land restored that was part of what he had given to them. Huge victory that the Lord provides as they come out of this gathering at Mizpah. Look at the way this closes here in chapter 7. Now Samuel judged Israel all the days of his life. Again, the reference to him judging Israel. Notice how it's repeated. He used to go annually on circuit to Bethel and Gilgal and Mizpah, and he judged Israel in all these places. Then his return was to Ramah, for his house was there, and there he judged Israel, and he built an altar to the Lord. We have judges in our legal system in Tennessee who ride circuits. Williamson County is part of a circuit, and the judges go to the various counties. Samuel had a circuit, and if we can get the, there it is. It's a little off to the side, but you see the dotted line, and Samuel's circuit is over here. Gilgal would be just a little off our slide, but Bethel, Mizpah, and Ramah, where he lived. You can see Jerusalem here. You get some idea, 5 to 7 miles up to Mizpah. So he had a small circuit in Benjamin and Manasseh. Those were the two tribes it touched on, that he traveled just to these cities, where it says that he sat as judge there. I will say to you again, I think Samuel's role as judge went beyond that of earlier judges. Samuel built an altar to the Lord at Ramah. I think he did that because there was no Shiloh, there was no tabernacle, there was no place of worship there. I believe he decided disputes among people and he dispensed justice in the land as they came to him with various issues. But I think he did more. I think he not only led them back to a relationship with the Lord, but with the erection of an altar, he was instructing them how to maintain that relationship. Samuel led the nation he judged in worship of the God whom they served. So we look at chapter 7. I think there's some principles we can pull from what we've seen from Samuel in this text. First, when Israel cried out to the Lord, Samuel spoke truth to them. He pointed out their sin. That's a bold thing to do. If you've never pointed out someone's sin to them, you don't know how bold that step is. But I think the key was Samuel waited until the moment was right. These people were pursuing the Lord, but they weren't hearing from God. And there was a huge elephant in their room, and it was their sin of idolatry. And Samuel dealt with them about that sin. They could not continue in that if they wanted God's blessing. They had to pursue him with their whole heart. And while we're not the Spirit of God in the lives of others, there are times when the door opens and it's time to speak even to speak regarding what the sin is in their lives that's separating them from the blessing of God. We certainly need to understand that we cannot continue in open, defiant sin and ever expect the blessing of God, no matter how much we pray or how great the crisis may be. Second, in leading others, I like the fact that Samuel dealt first with the spiritual issue. Parents, don't miss this with your children. As you deal with and correct bad behavior, be sure for kids who have put their faith in Christ that they understand the offense is against Him. They've sinned against Him. They need to confess that, acknowledge that. There may be somebody else that they need to make things right with as well. I think it's often easy for us to focus on that. Go to Johnny, tell him you're sorry you hit him upside the head. You know, and Johnny, forgive. And that's important. But it's first that we recognize if you've claimed a relationship with Christ, that we recognize the sin, the offense is toward Him, and that needs to be made right. I love what James says at chapter 4, verse 6. God is opposed to the proud, but He gives grace to the humble. The confession of sin was humbling for Israel. They really acted on it first and then verbalized their wrong. Great thing to do, but once you humble yourself, then you receive the grace of God. The same when somebody points out sin to us. The confession of it is humbling because we own it through that. And then we can receive the grace of God and begin to move forward again. Also, don't miss that Samuel led the nation in worship during the time that he judged them. Again, here I will say to you parents, and especially to dads, let me be very clear. Let your children see you set the example in worship here on Sundays, at other times with your families. Dads have the primary responsibility, the first responsibility. Mothers are not exempt to set the example for the family in worship. Don't neglect that, whether it's here or in other occasions that you have to worship as a family. Samuel's life gives us instruction today, I think, at multiple levels. At multiple levels as he dealt with the nation. Silence for 20 years. But it took 20 years, it seems, before Israel cried out and really wanted to pursue the Lord. Then they needed to know how. And somebody needed to step up and tell them how. And that was Samuel. And now all the nation has come together and we're positioned. The very next thing we'll get to in chapter 8 is Israel crying out for a king, asking for a king. And it's going to confound Samuel at first. But the Lord says, rest easy. Rest easy. He's in charge. And they'll get a king of their own choosing first, and they'll get a king then of the Lord's choosing. It's a great plan and picture that's unfolding. I hope we can stay back far enough from it that we see how beautiful it is as it unfolds, including this today, and also be close enough to it that we can learn from the particulars of it. Pray with me, if you will. Father, as your words run through our minds and our thoughts, we think about our lives. So often pointing to you and at the same time grasping something else of the world that we want to hold on to. I thank you for clear words to us from the days of the judges and the judge and prophet Samuel, that for us to have your blessing, we have to stand before you with no God but you. Wholly committed to you, Father. If we get nothing else from that, I pray we would get that for each of our lives today, that we might be encouraged to walk in full commitment to you in releasing the other things, and yes, even confessing the sin that is ours for where we've held on and tried to do things that were not honoring to you while we also tried to worship you. Thank you for these great examples, Father, that bore, I think, right into my heart and our hearts as to where we live today. Use this, I pray, by your Spirit in our lives for Jesus' sake.